Thank you. Well, good morning. Let's go to the Lord in prayer. Gracious God, as we bow before you this morning, it is a wonderful blessing to be able to claim, because of the word work of Christ in our lives, that it is well with our souls. And we praise you and bless you for that work. And Lord, I thank you for bringing all the folks out this morning to learn more about what you have for us, and the privilege that you give us to be able to impart your truth to the people you bring across our paths. And Lord, we never want to take that for granted. So would you open our minds again this morning and help us to learn something new about you today. And we pray this in Christ's name. Amen. You know, speaking of that, I am thoroughly convinced that the only reason we're here after we're saved is because God has got something for us, right? I mean, why else would we be here? And that something, of course, is people. But start with a book giveaway. Ready? Another Andy Griffith trivia. This one should be easier, but it's kind of a two-part question. The first question doesn't win, the first answer doesn't win the book, but it primes the thoughts. There was a band, then they lived out in the country, and it was a dad, a daughter, and the boys. What was the name of the family? And the dad's name, it was, what was the dad's name? Darling is the name. The dad's name. How about the daughter's name? And the boys were just the boys. But... and the boys never talked. You ever notice that? They were a good bluegrass band, by the way. But the dad's name was Briscoe, darling. The daughter's name was Charlene. All right. What instrument did the dad play? The jug. He won two books. I hope you didn't buy any.
You're going to the library.
There you go. Okay. All right. He played the jug. That's right.
He got too much time on his hands.
Yeah. Obviously, I do as well, right? Too many Andy Griffith episodes. But all right, so this morning we're going to get into our second session. That's hard to believe, but I'm going to try and get through this one quick so we can get somewhat back on track and not cut short at the end. But the end ones are, you know, just kind of exercises and whatnot. So this one is crucial, the information here. So I want you to understand that, and we talked about some of this will be repetitive from last night, so maybe it's good that we waited to this morning to do it so it can kind of refresh us. But again, it doesn't matter what the addiction is, whether it's alcohol or heroin or gambling or pornography or shopping, all addictions, get this now, all of them involve chemicals. Keep that in your mind, right? If a substance, it's either introduced into the body, such as alcohol, drugs, and that those are chemicals, or in the case of like gambling, it is a chemical that the body itself produces. All right, so we either got something coming from the outside in, or something that's in us that's already doing it. And we could say that these chemicals they're either foreign or natural. You could call that foreign would be like an alcohol that we put in. The feeling somebody gets when they pull the handle on the slot machine comes from within their bodies. And, you know, it's not necessarily, here's maybe a better way of explaining it. I heard this explained the other day by somebody. If Rod's sitting there, if he had a really nice big navel orange right now, and he started peeling it, right, and everybody around, you know, you're going to start to smell it, right? You're going to, and you know what starts to happen, not only to him but you, that's maybe 10, 20 feet away, as that scent, you know, moves through the room. Chemicals fire in our brains, right? And they cause a reaction in us. So that's one way to look at the natural chemicals. So they're either from inside the body or outside of the body, but they both contribute to addiction. No matter what the addiction is, chemicals are involved. So in all addictions, we must deal with the inner man and the outer man. You know, we have to realize that there is a physiological, a body component, as well as a heart component, the inner self component, we could call it. So whether it's a foreign substance somebody's putting into their body or a chemical reaction from the body itself, these both put pressure on the heart. Now, of course, by the heart, I'm not talking about the blood, you know what I'm meaning by heart. You know, I believe that, you know, the heart, the mind, the soul, our spirit, whatever you want to call it, that's all the same thing. It's what makes you you. It's what makes me me. But these things, they all put pressure on our hearts. This is where cravings come in. You hear people talking about cravings. You know, another way to answer cravings would be, another word would be like pleasurable feelings. That's where all these things come from within us. That's where withdrawal comes from, right? These are all physiological responses that influence our hearts. And that's what makes it somebody want to do it again. And again, I think I said this last night, if I lined up and I could say their names, but at one time in the program, you know, I had a heroin addict, a gambling addict, a pornography addict, and an alcoholic, and a drug, I guess the heroin was a drug addict, you know, maybe another kind of drug addict. We usually had 4 to 5 guys at a time. And if I lined them up here and did not let you know what their addiction was, what chemical, whether they were putting it in or their body was producing it, you could ask them every, and you weren't allowed to ask them what their addiction was. You were just, if you just interviewed them and asked them questions, you couldn't tell the heroin guy from the pornography guy. You couldn't. The pull, the work on the heart is the same for either. So it's very important for biblical counselors to recognize that addictions include both the heart and the body components. So you may need, at some point, depending upon the substance, you may need a medical doctor to help you address some of those body issues. Don't count them out. However, disclaimer, you got to find one that believes in biblical counseling. You got to find one that believes in God and not just medicate everybody to the hill, right? But you need to cover your bases as a counselor and recommend somebody go to a medical doctor. We were blessed that we have a guy, he's not in our church anymore, but he lived a long way away and got tired of driving after 10 years and found they finally had a decent church in his town that somebody planted, and he's going there now. But he's still friends with everybody at our church, and I would take the guys in the program to him, and it was kind of covering my bases, if you will. There's a lot of organic problems with our bodies can have pressure on us, I guess the way to say it, to make us behave in a way that's not conducive to glorifying God, and we need medical professionals to weed those things out for us. The thyroid is a biggie. The thyroid can mask itself into all kinds of depressions, and so, you know, you can do all the counseling in the world with somebody that's got an organic problem, and if it's not being addressed by a medical doctor, you're not going to be able to help them. So we have to stay on top of that, and especially if you're dealing with somebody with an opioid withdrawal or alcohol, those both are big, and alcohol, believe it or not, probably the biggest. Be careful, because people can go into cardiac arrest withdrawing from alcohol. And the last thing you need to do is have somebody in your home that you're not seeking medical help for, and they have a heart attack and die from withdrawal. So you got to really be careful with that. But as I said, the challenge is finding a medical doctor that will agree with you, and it's not going to just, I mean, the drug swap thing, it's out of control. I don't know how it is here in Tallahassee, but you can drive around Woodstock, where I live, you know, and you see signs, the real estate signs that they put out, you know, for opioid treatment, Suboxone clinic. That's a drug swap. That is an absolute drug swap, you know, from one addictive drug to another. Oh, yeah, but he's getting it from a doctor now, and you know, or the methadone clinics. I know you got those here, you know, and that's just legal heroin. I mean, I have never, I'm sure this has happened, but personally, I have never heard of a methadone clinic doing what they were designed to do. They were designed to get people off of heroin, and I suppose they do that, but the design was just, I don't know what the dosages are. Let's just hypothetically say that a gram a day a heroin user is going to need 50 milligrams a day of methadone. Well, the whole concept is to step down. You know, like next week you only get 48 milliliters, the next week 40, and so forth till you get down to zero. Well, guess what? It's a money-making machine. So I'm not going to back you off, and then you're just on methadone for the rest of your life. And it is safer than heroin because there's no needles involved or whatever, but it's not helping anybody. And any of the state hospitals, the people are—they're actually, and this is an honest truth, that they're going to come out on more drugs than they went in with. They just are, and that's the world's way. So you do need the medical professionals. The problem is finding one that's not going to just treat with everything under the sun as a drug swab. So find a good doctor, and that you can help you work through the issues, particularly with opioids and alcohol. Those are the two biggies for the physiological side of things. Cocaine and meth, not so much. But so let's talk about then levels of addiction, levels that you'll have to deal with. Now, this material came from Paul Tripp at a seminar in Lafayette, Indiana, from 2008. And the first level of addiction that we want to look at is called symptom addiction. Now this is the symptom is the sign that we all observe from somebody, right? This is the slavery to some physical substance like drugs or alcohol, a foreign substance that's introduced into the body, and it's slavery to some pleasurable activity that brings a physiological reward, you know, the pornography, the video games, the gambling. So you've got both of these, again, hammering this point of the foreign substance or the substance that's within the body. And a friend of mine has done a lot of research. He's actually doing his D-Men thesis on addiction in the local church. And he has really researched, and I would just do it total injustice to try and explain it, but it's something of this nature. Whether we put a substance in or the body produces it, the chemical that is fired in the brain that produces the pleasurable feeling is dopamine. Okay, so let's just hypothetically say this is where I'm going to really blow it, but that's not hypothetical. I am going to really blow it, but the hypothetical is this, that let's just say that right now sitting here, our brains are operating, firing at 10, whatever the measurement is of dopamine. And then maybe somebody walked in here with a, what's your best biscuit? I don't like Chick-fil-A biscuits. I love Chick-fil-A, but Bojangles. Have you got those here? I like a Bojangles biscuit. So somebody just walked in with a box of Bojangles biscuits, and they're walking up and down. You know, the dopamine fires, and let's say it goes up to a 20. Well, you can never, your body can't reach that 20 without the firing, right? You can only get to a 10. Well, what these substances do is they peak that in somebody, and then your body can only do a 10. That's all it can do, and you want more and more, so you have to keep doing and doing to get you, and you can never get to the 20 again. Does that make sense? I mean, that's really botching it. Yes, ma'am.
One of the people we discovered recently called the pleasurable threshold.
There you go. That's a great term, the pleasurable threshold. And you can't get there again. I have talked to people, like I said last night, the ministry I had downtown Atlanta in the crack neighborhood, I've talked with people that tell me that first hit, they can't get back there. That's why they do it and 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 do it. They're always chasing that first high. And so we call this symptom addiction because you're dealing with the physical substance, the alcohol, the drug, or the experience. And but we know that it's not really that isn't really the problem, is it? We got to deal with that. Undoubtedly, you got to deal with that. But if we have someone that is an alcoholic, a drunkard, we got to get rid of the substance, right, or the activity. We have to address that as part of what Matthew chapter 5, we're going to look at that later, but that's what we would call as counselors radical amputation. You know, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off, right? And so we got to be about that, right? We know that in their hearts there's a second level of addiction, and it's not the beer, it's not the gambling, it's what we call God replacements. They're replacing God with something, and we would call that what? An idol, right? These are idols. And there's something that's ruling and driving their heart that leads them to seek satisfaction in these substances or in this act. Something instead of finding their satisfaction in God. And, you know, we also have to deal with another one, though, that's caused the causal addiction. You know, well, what are those things? These are the God replacements, the ruling that's ruling the heart. So we have to address things like, what are the desires of the heart? You got to walk through these things with people is what I'm getting at. You know, and you're not going to do this all in one setting, right? But we're going to see how to build on that here in a minute. So what are the desires of the heart? The lust of the flesh, as Ephesians 2:3 talks about. What are the lies that are being embraced? We have to address those with people and get them to talk about it. You know, we're going to look at data gathering in a minute, but counselors are, unlike therapists, you sit there and you talk, right? Biblical counselors, we're investigators. You got to draw out of them, and you'll find this was absolutely amazing to me, absolutely amazing. You will find that when people are really in the throes of it and they're really wanting out of it and they can't get out of it and they don't know how to get out of it, they become, in a bizarre way, brutally honest. I mean, they want to answer. They want to tell. I mean, they're searching. You know, they want to know how to get out of this. So what lies are being embraced? And number three, what are the habits that have formed? You know, maybe what drives that person back to their substance is, you know, I can't deal with my life. It's too painful. It's too overwhelming. It's too hopeless. I've got a guy right now that I've been working with for about 3 months. My wife's working with his wife. And this guy, I hate it for him. He grew up as a missionary kid in France, but his parents are just nut job missionaries. And they shipped him off to a boarding school in Germany. He hadn't talked to him in 14 years. Can you imagine that? 14 years, and they're serving in Vietnam now, and you know, I said, you know, so he's got that chip, you know, and I'm not a Freudian psychologist. I'm not saying you're an alcoholic because your parents treated you poorly, but I'm showing you, you know, that you got to draw this out of people, and so this guy, and this is hard. He travels for a living, not every week, but at least 1 week out of the month, and he gets away and he ties it on, you know, and then he comes home and they fight like cat and dog, and it's just not good. But he told me, well, it happened again the other night, and he called me, it was Thursday night, and he said, I just don't know what, he called me from the airport. I just don't know what I'm going to do. She's not going to let me come back home. And I was like, you know, well, what did you expect, right? But to get, he is in a hopeless place right now, right? That's what I wanted to say, all that to say that. But so the his symptom addiction is another drink. You know what? That does kill his pain. Don't ever think that, well, why are you doing it? Does. That gal asked last night why I drank. Mine wasn't to kill pain, but I liked the way it made me feel. That's why I did it. It had an effect on me that my flesh liked. This guy has legitimate emotional pain. You know, and by the way, a sidebar here, that's one of the downfalls of the medicines that so many physicians prescribe. They take the emotions away. We weren't created to go through life like this, right? This is life, isn't it? Where do you grow? You don't grow up here in the mountaintop. You grow down here in the valleys, in the dark places of life, right? And so when you're on this plane like this, and you're just sitting there drooling because you're so doped up from, you know, that you can't deal with the heart. So we got to be about dealing with the heart. And you know, I'm telling you, these substances work. Now, who do you think's behind that, right? Satan's all over that. You know, that this will kill your pain, and it does. But what? Only for a little bit. And then what happens? Now you got all these compounding problems over here. Mama's upset. I got to go to a hotel. I can't stay in my home anymore. You know, hopefully not crash the car and kill somebody else. But you got all these compounding problems. Well, I feel, what do? Have another drink, right? And it kills the pain. But God, I mean, emotions are a great gift from our loving God, right? And us guys struggle with that more than the women typically, but you know, keep in mind that these things do work, right? The causal addiction, what I'm saying is somebody that's trying to deal with the hard things of life apart from God, using a God replacement to do what only God can really do. So, you know, we can get somebody off the physical substance. As I said last night, AA can do that. But if we haven't addressed the issues in the heart, guess what? We haven't really helped them. You know, we got to get down to the heart issues. And so this sounds weird, but, you know, I think some wives, if it's the guy, a lot of wives, I think they get mad at me because they think, I'm telling you, and I don't want to downplay this, so this is really hard to say and hard to explain, but the fact that the guy went out and snorted some meth last night, you know, it's not the end of the world, you know. I mean, it's, you know, he was escaped, you know, whatever. You get what I mean by that? I mean, it's the consequences of these kind of things are just absolutely devastatingly more severe than telling a lie to your, you know, kids or whatever. But it is still a hard issue that has to be addressed. And that's where we got to start getting laserly focused, is on the heart. What are the desires of the heart? What in you are you discontent with? I love the word contentment back there. It's over there, too. And sidebar story on that one. Our home got destroyed in 2008 by a tornado. I mean, cut in half. We had to move out for 5 months while they rebuilt it. Well, you know why it got cut in half? God's sovereign, right? So we were preparing to go to Peru. And my wife was going to be teaching a ladies' Bible study on contentment. She prayed that morning, God, you know I do really well with word pictures. You know, help me. And that afternoon, we don't have a home anymore. You know, and she continued her study, and she found, you know, in her study that the Lord, he never promised. He said that he would, I can't remember the text, it's in Timothy, you know, pardon? There you go. Yeah, you know? So we're like, golly, why'd you have to ask God for that? But so she was able to go to Peru and teach ladies that live in dirt floor adobe huts, you know? And so anyway, again, we can get people off of the physical substance, but we got to be about addressing their hearts, right? We haven't really helped them if we haven't. So, you know, I met with a guy who traveled for a living one time, not the guy I was talking about a minute ago, another one. This guy was a pilot, and he intentionally took these flights that would hold him over at a place, you know, if they fly X amount of hours, they have to stay there for X amount of days, and he would get tanked in the time that he was there, and he absolutely was not interested in God, and so he made AA's religion, and I'm grateful that he is a pilot that is sober. Now, yeah, I don't know if he's ever been my pilot. He flew with Delta, that's a big airline, you know, but But the point is, you know, is that he's found his refuge now in a program rather than in Christ. And you know, all of us are hardwired for worship, right? And we must and we are going to worship something. Read Romans chapter 1, and you know, whatever that may be. So the chart that you have there kind of shows how this whole heart thing goes. So look at the first one there, and first there's a heart struggle. That's the mind. So you know, and this could be, again, you know, my wife and I got into a disagreement, an argument, a fight, whatever you want to call it. Well, the mind then, if you just come down on the right there, you know, to handle my heart, my mind problem, I struggle, so I introduce a physical substance. I introduce a 40-ounce Budweiser or whatever. I'm sure I'm glad they didn't have those things when I drank. They were just either 12 or 16, but now they got 40s. But so I introduce a physical substance. Well, what happens? It ultimately fails, right? It ultimately fails. My heart is not satisfied, and you come around, and the failure of that substance causes me to crave more, and off to the races you go. And another way of saying that is in that Heart of Addiction book, Mark Shaw explains that you know, everything starts in the mind. The mind affects my affections. It affects the way I feel. My feelings then drive my actions. It's the same concept here, right? And off you go. And that physical substance, or the gambling or whatever, the chemicals from within that we talked about, they never fully satisfy my heart. And so I'm always craving more and more and more. And you know, I mean, you could almost look at that without it being a sinful thing and just see it like, guys, you know, well, does anybody play golf, right? I mean, have you ever seen that you can't ever have, you know, what keeps a golfer going back out there, right? Always to try and get that one next best shot. I had one guy told me, he explained, he was a great golfer, and he said it's called chasing the pill. The white pill, that golf ball, you know, same type of thing, right? But look at the next chart there. This would be what we could call the biblical model. Guess what? There's a heart struggle, right? It's there, it's real. My wife and I got into an argument, a disagreement, a fight, a real heart struggle. But instead of turning to a substance or an activity, I turn to Christ and his word, and perhaps other believers come around the chart. My heart is satisfied, and guess what? New habits are formed. The same circle is there, right? But we're handling it in two completely different ways. Instead of adding something, I'm going to God and his word and brothers and sisters in Christ to help me walk through that. So how are we going to help people? What procedures are you and I going to take at this level to get them to turn to this biblical model rather than the one above it? Well, first, we got to be involved in data gathering. This is flat out biblical counseling 101, right? Data gathering. We got to start with like external factors. Family. What's your family life like? Job, finances, relationships. You know, it's interesting, in the ACBC training, they talk about 1 hour sessions. I don't know what in the world that is. Never had one, you know, unless the person leaves, you know, but, and that has happened as well. But, you know, other than that, you know, it just doesn't happen. But you got to guard yourself. You don't want to be there all afternoon with them, right? This isn't time for them to bash their wife for 3 hours, you know, but you're gathering family information. You're gathering information about their job, their finances, their relationships. I had a new guy I'm working with, and you know, I was patient and took a lot of time learning all his background and everything. Again, not to practice Freudian psychology. I'm not looking for something back here in the back that that's why you do it, because your mom was mean to you that time. None of that, but just you want to know their history, right? And it helps them to be able to give that. But my wife, on the other hand, I was hoping she was supposed to be here, but I said last night she had to back out at the last minute, but so I can talk about her since she's not here. But she had somebody recently that her in the ACBC counseling training, once you have the classes and the tests, and now you're ready to move to the next phase. You have supervised counseling, and that's, you know, the your supervisor's not in the room with you, but you're taking notes. You submit those to him, and then you guys have a Skype call together, and you talk about it. Well, Lou Priolo was my wife's supervisor, and he told her, this one of her homework assignments was to get a Sherlock Holmes and read it, because she didn't ask enough questions. And he said, you got to learn how to ask more questions. So here's an example of that. She was meeting with a lady. This has been years ago. She was meeting with a lady, and, you know, I didn't want the details. We don't sit around the table and talk about, man, you wouldn't believe that guy. He's really messed up. You know, we don't do that. But she came home, you know, and I said, it was her first visit with a lady. And I said, well, and she wasn't in our church. I didn't know. And I said, well, you know, how was your session? Oh, it was good. And I said, well, you know, what's her problem? And my wife said, well, her husband's in the Army, and she's missing him, and, you know, she just needed, you know, prayer and anxiety. And I was really, oh, well, where's he at? No, he's in Afghanistan. And well, what's he do? I really don't know. He's a lieutenant general. And I'm like, oh, what? That's a 3-star general. This is a big dog. This is a real big dog. I said, you realize that this guy will have memoirs written about him. This isn't a Tim Brown, the sergeant, right? And she's like, well, what's the big deal? So she's in the office at home the next week, and she was having her visit with Lou Priolo, and they were reviewing this case. And I just happened to walk by. I wasn't eavesdropping, I promise. I just happened to walk by, and I heard him, well, what does her husband do? Well, he's in the Army, you know. Well, what's he doing in the Army? Well, he's in charge of the war. He's the commander of V Corps, you know. And I heard Lou, what? And she said, you know, he's a lieutenant general. And what? And I was like, wow, you know. So I said, well, when he comes back, you got to get back with her. We got to go out to dinner with these people, you know. I've never hobnobbed with somebody like that. But you got to be asking questions, right? I mean, just things like that. What do you do? And things of that nature. Those are the external factors. Then there's the internal factors, right? What was he thinking? What was he wanting? You know, and again, not in a Freudian sense, but this guy I've recently been meeting with, like I said, you know, how poorly he was treated as a child and all, that was here's how that helped me to gain that information. It brought me to the realization that this guy was viewing his life as a victim, right? I'm a victim of the way I was raised. Therefore, I can justify, and again, it worked. He can drink himself into oblivion. You know, we need to do this so that we can address those issues later. So I know, you know, when you're taking notes and you're counseling and you've got your agenda there, you know, you got little sidebar notes going over here, right? Like this deal with his folks. That needs to be addressed. But, you know, but you can come to those things later. So next, there are common factors. And these come from Stuart Scott. I don't know. You said you had Stuart here in your church. These are from his counseling class at Master Seminary in 99, that some of the common factors is that, do they have an inaccurate view of themselves, right? Maybe they think they have a brain problem, a disease, or maybe they think they're a great person that just struggles with this, right? Another one is a common factor is avoidance of conflicts or trials, right? And again, though, as Christians, trials are put into our life for what? To produce change, right? We grow through those things. The James chapter 1, consider it all joy, not if you go through various trials, but what? When? In other words, you're going to have it. Third common factor is a lack of trust in God. And, you know, we got to counsel people that, is God really faithful? I mean, is he? And you got to get people to go through that in their minds, and you can get their thinking to start to change. You know what? I can depend on him. Got to get them there. And number four would be perfectionist tendencies. You know, there's a lot of us, I'm not one of them, but that can't handle life unless it's perfect. Those people kind of drive me crazy. But number five is a desire for a quick fix. And you know what? It is much much, much easier to pop a pill or pop a beer than it is to deal with the problem the way God wants us to deal with it. It's much easier to get the quick fix. And a lot of people, number six, motivated by fear. Seven, patterns and habits. Those are very, very real, right? Every one of us is so habit and pattern driven that I guarantee you not a one of you consciously thought about putting your shoes on this morning. And all of a sudden, there they are on your feet. Right? You didn't think, okay, how am I going to tie this thing again? You know, I forgot how to tie, so I'm using slip-ons now. No. But, you know, same thing. Think of an automobile. Think of how we get in those things now. We don't think about it at all. Next thing you know, you're going down the road at 70 miles an hour. Wow. But think of the first time you did it, right? Scared to death. So patterns and habits, those are very real that we get into and we got to address those. You got to be gathering all of this data as you're meeting with these people. And so what I do a lot of times after a meeting when the people are gone, I usually don't do it right then, but sometime shortly thereafter, I rewrite my notes because I got stuff going all over the place as they're talking. And don't be afraid to tell somebody when you're writing notes, could you give me a second? You know, I don't write real fast here, and I want to get this down so I understand. And you may find something in your data gathering, as I said, that you've put over here as a sidebar, but now that's you're gonna pluck a homework assignment for that issue at some point in the future. And you want to, when you get back home and you're looking over your notes, you say, oh yeah, I got this resource there that later, and you write that down in the notes, assign this for homework. And then number eight is peer pressure. That's a very common factor. A lot of alcohol and drug use starts with peer pressure, which, what is a better word biblically for peer pressure? I think would be the fear of man, right? And you know what? A lot of times that's a parent, right? That people are, I mean, that's sad to say, isn't it? I know a friend of mine that teaches at a middle school, and he said, you would be shocked of how many cars pull up in the morning, mom, dad dropping the kid off, and the door opens, and the smell of marijuana just will knock you down, smoking weed in middle school on the way to school with mom or dad. Peer pressure. And then another one would be triggers, and that's a buzzword, kind of a secular buzzword, but I think it's in there to help us understand what we're talking about here. But a better word would be what? Temptations, from a biblical perspective, right? And these are the triggers. These temptations could be failures of reminders of the past. Financial pressure could be a trigger or temptations. You know, some people that God, when God saves us, He takes the desire for these things away. I would be lying and I would be a fool to say, well, if you still crave it, you're not saved. That's not true at all, right? There may be a guy that was a scotch on the rocks addict, you know, and every time for the rest of his life, he hears an ice cube hit the cup, it tempts him, it triggers him. You know, I mean, we need to know those things. Mark in The Heart of Addiction talks about a gal he counseled in Birmingham that she had to get to the point where she couldn't drink a Coke or a Pepsi or whatever out of a can, because just the feel of that 12-ounce can in her hand tempted her to those past things. And so we need to know those things from the people we're counseling. Then we can start to build our arsenal for them. So next, so we're always gathering data, always. This never stops, and we're getting lots and lots of it. So next, though, then we got to move into what we would call radical amputation. So let's read together real quick Matthew 5. 29 and 30, unless somebody has it memorized, and you could quote it for us. You'll know it as soon as we say it. But this is the verses 27 through 30. Really, we'll just read the whole little paragraph there. It says, you have heard that it was said, Jesus speaking, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. So this is what we would call radical amputation, right? If the letter A, if the substance is a medication or an illegal drug or alcohol, then, as I said before, a physician should likely be involved. But if the behavior has any significant physical or medical factors, even beyond substances like you could have anorexia or a cutting, you need to have a physician involved. And radical amputation, though, it includes all of these factors related to addiction. You know, it could be the substances. You got to get them out of your life. It could be relationships. It could be influences. It could be locations that you have. It could be cell phones that you have. It could be computers. You know, and if somebody is serious, guess what? They're going to do these things. You can tell straight away if a pornography addict is really interested in change when you tell him, get rid of the smartphone. You got to go back to a flip phone. And if he pitches a fit, he's not serious, right? Because it will be, I will go to whatever measure necessary to have change in my life. So, you know, lots of TV programs that they may have to change what they watch on TV, right? And, you know, I mean, I watch TV, so I'm not dogging TV, but it's an interesting thing here. What is facing the television in all of our living rooms? The couch, the chair, everything's pointed right at it, right? I mean, look at me, right? It's kind of interesting when you think of it that way. You know, but, you know, a lot of these shows are all about people hanging out at the bars. All of the fireman shows, all the medical shows, all those, what do they end up with at the end of the show? They're at a bar, right? Hanging out. You know, that's the stereotypical way to end your day. You know, and the camaraderie that goes into that, I mean, we're social beings, right? And the camaraderie and the sociality, if that's a word, that goes into that is very attractive. We want that. We desire that. We crave that. So TV knows that, so they depict it, right? I mean, you look at the beer ads on the football seasons. You know, what's going on there, right? Money, beautiful women, camaraderie, a good time. Well, guess what? Have you ever seen a Budweiser ad with the guy that lives in a tent under the bridge? You know, why not? You know, because they're not going to sell any alcohol if the end result is that, right? I mean, it's just, it's not going to be there. But we don't see those things. And so we have to identify with them these issues in their lives, you know, that, you know, and you'll get some guys, well, I'm just going to, I'm going to go to the bar as a missionary, you know. No, you know, that doesn't work, you know. Or for young people, the one is, have you heard this term? I'm going to be a missionary dater, right? I'm going to date lost girls, right? That doesn't work, right? So cutting these things out of their lives, it has to be more than just stop drinking beer or whatever it is, right? And guess what? It's true for video gamers, too. I left that one out. I hadn't even thought about it till right now. I mean, I know of young men that literally stay up all night playing video games, right? There's interactive video games now, they tell me. I've never seen one, but you play with different people from all over the world. You know, guess what? Then it's, oh, now it's time to go to school. Oh, I hadn't even been to bed. Right? Those things have to be cut off. I had a lady recently, my wife, and I kid you not, her son was like this. And I said, well, take his computer away. Oh, he'll melt down. I can't do that. He goes in there and locks his door and I can't get in. She's divorced. And I said, excuse me? And I said, do you want me to come over and take the door off and put it in the, he could, what do you mean he? Who's the adult here? Right? So we got to cut these things out of our lives. And you and I have to take measures like that as well, right? I mean, we know what tempts us, and whether you want to call it a trigger or a temptation, and we just have to avoid those things. We have to be very, very comprehensive with radical amputation. So how will we know how to do this? Well, good data gathering, really getting to know them and understand them and all their different ways. They're giving themselves into these things. So they'll actually start naming these things that have to be cut off. In your questioning, they'll start naming them, and you can start to build your list. So we have to think about this problem as it relates to all areas of life. So what is really going on? What is really going on, and what is it really going to involve? So Roman numeral 4 is this chart of total life restructuring. This is out of Jay Adams' book, Competent to Counsel. And we have to address all these things, right? Like how is the addiction affecting your school, your work, and just work through this wheel. And you can work through this wheel with anything. It doesn't have to be just addiction, right? So you got the problem in the center, and you have to address every one of these. excuse me. You know, I love the one when you get to the social activities and the friends. That's when you really find out where the rubber's meeting the road with them. So first, this means letter A, looking at the problem in relationship to all areas of the life and seeing how all these areas contribute towards the solution. And structure is often essential for affecting the twofold change, Adam says, that we're discussing. Structure helps both in putting off and putting on. You know, there's undoubtedly going to be some friendships, some hobbies, some activities that are contributing to their problem, like watching a football game. You know, if that's something you love to do and your person loves to do, and you know, I mean, in my former life, the football game, you didn't even turn the TV on unless you had a case of beer, right? And so, well, there's nothing wrong with watching football, but why not get together with a group of guys from church or whatever to watch football with, you know, cutting off those relationships. Jay Adams says, letter C there, when a counselee prays in faith for change, his faith should extend to works that are consistent with his prayer. You know, watching something on TV and all of a sudden there's an inappropriate clad individual bowing your head and praying, oh God, help me not to lust, and looking back up at it afterward, not going to work. Pick up the remote, change the channel. Make your works consistent with your prayer. If he prays for deliverance from a smoking habit, he should stop buying cigarettes. If he wants to overcome an impure thought life, he must burn the girly magazines. You can tell how old that is, that statement. Get rid of the phone now, right? If he wishes to get rid of a bad temper, he should abandon the company of others with a similar problem. Thus, the structure of one's activities surrounding and association should be consistent and aid his avowed desire to put off sinful practice. Equally important, since change is two-factored, he must structure for the new practice that he wishes to develop. And Stuart Scott calls this structuring your life for godliness, which means that you're looking for areas of your life. You know, what things am I going to do that make godliness difficult? And I need to change those. What can I do to cultivate new godly habits, right? It involves something that none of us likes to do. What do you think that is? Work, right? Thinking and doing. Why can't I? No. If you're going to, I mean, you can't radically amputate something without taking action, right? It may be something as simple as driving a different route home. For the guy that's an alcoholic, just simply not going by the beer store. Take a different route. I don't care. Well, there's beer there too. Well, there are some roads that don't have beer, you know, that you can get to, but... And if there's not, then here's what I tell guys to do. I literally explain it to people like this. Then build an Ebenezer. That could be another trivia question. What is an Ebenezer? Pardon? There you go. A monument of God's faithfulness, right? Build one. So the passage is for that is 1 Samuel 7:12. The Lord had helped Samuel, and the stone that he put there, the Ebenezer, was a spot where the Philistines were defeated. So building that, you know, we are so bad, not bad, this is good, but we beat ourselves up all the time when we sin, right? Again, well, how often, here's what we don't do. How often do you celebrate the victories, right? I mean, we need to be doing that. I kid you not, when I was a new believer, I would high-five the Holy Spirit behind my back like this. You know, as I would walk through life, I'd be talking to somebody, I'd be, you know, I would be high, celebrate those things. And so Ebenezer's are a way to do that. So then the next time you drive by that convenience store and you didn't pull in, there's your Ebenezer over there. Look at it. You can celebrate it. And I taught this to the guys in my program. And one day I got in the ministry truck with them, in the pickup truck, and the bed of the truck was full of rocks. And I said, well, what in the world are you guys doing with those things? And they were big rocks. And I said, well, we're building Ebenezers. And I was like, what? So we left the neighborhood there and driving down there. Sure enough, there they were. And they had them built on the front porch and all over the place. And, but those are ways for us to celebrate where God has worked in our lives and delivered us. And, you know, I'm not a feelings guy, but you know, we talked about emotions. That makes you feel good. You had a victory. It really does work, right? But we got to put something into it, right? I had a guy, actually talked to him the other night. This is years ago. He went through the program, and he left. 6 months he was with me. The very day he left, he drove from Woodstock back to Birmingham. He went to pick his dogs up at this person's house that was keeping them for him while he was with me, and he went down his crack dealer's road, and he bought dope. The very day, after 6 months, you know, not that he wouldn't have done it if he went another way, but, you know, didn't make sense to go. And he knew it. He'll tell you that right now. You know, it was all, the car didn't automatically turn down that road. You know, as I said last night, you know, no, the devil, it can't make you do those things. It's you, it's your flesh, it's the indwelling sin, and as you think those things through. So, you know, we have to implement radical change into their lives. And nowadays, you know, we're dealing with teenagers, you can track them and see where they're going, right? I guess wives can do that as well. But, you know, for pornography, you know, it can include installing software, passwords. You know, those things, though, keep in mind, those things don't change the heart. But what we're doing is we're creating a context where godliness is more conducive. Listen to this, a great passage in Colossians chapter 2. Paul writes, you know, he's dealing with, you know, these rules and regulations, right? And I talked a little bit about that last night. And Paul says, therefore, this is Colossians 2:16, therefore let no one pass judgment on you in question of food and drink, or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Let no one disqualify you, insisting on asceticism, worship of angels, going on in detail about visions, puffed up without reason by his sensuous mind, and not holding fast to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with the growth that is from God. Now listen to this. For if with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world, why, as if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, don't drive down that street, get a filter, yada, yada, yada. Get me? Those are good precautions to take, but do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, referring to things that all perish as they are used, according to the human precepts and teachings. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but, you know how it ends? They are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. So the internet filters and all that for pornography, that's not going to stop the desire of the flesh. That is something that through the Spirit of God, we've got to work out. It's great to have those things as protections, but if you tell somebody, well, yeah, get this filter, then you're not going to ever look at porn. No, that's not, that doesn't work that way, right? What those things do, driving a different route, hanging out with these people instead of those, all those things, they create some breathing room so that we and they can address their hearts rather than being tempted and allowing that trigger that temptation to gain a foothold. These are things, as I said, that we call structuring your life for godliness. And, you know, we can't do this without a clear picture of the problem. And the Matthew 5 gives us a clear picture of the problem. It's us, right, as I said last night, because we know the real issue is the heart, right? Matthew 23:25 says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but the inside, they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, and the outside also may be clean." So we got to do it inward, right? And you haven't really changed at all, really, until you've cleaned the inside. The inside must be clean. So, letter D, that brings us to, in part of this radical amputation, what things need to be put off? What items need to be put on? What other ways should the counselees structure their life for godliness? Here's a biggie. For anybody with an addiction problem, a substance addiction, no money. You can't buy it. Nobody gives dope away. Well, sometimes they do to get you hooked. But for the most part, once you're in that stage, you can't go in a store and buy alcohol without money. You know, so no money. Maybe they don't need to have cash. Get somebody in the church to help with that, a financial accountability person. You know, and think about this. You know, I've had guys tell me, you know, it's really strange, but not having any money actually brought me peace. And that temptation was gone. I knew I couldn't get anything, right? So now let's really get at the seat of the issue. We're all right on time? No, okay. Yeah, we're almost done with this one. 5 minutes. The seat of the issue, this is number five, the heart in addiction, right? Remember, we talked about symptom addiction, causal addiction, and you know, these involve things, right? So really, addictions are idol revealers. They're God replacements, as I said. And so we need to get to the heart. So letter A, what are the ruling desires of their heart? These are what you could call I must have. You know, I gotta have, the I wants, the needs, the expectations. For the guy that's drinking because of financial pressure, he'd say, I just got to have financial freedom. You know, well, there's no promises of that. What happens when you get that? It's something else, right? The Bible says, don't set your hopes on the uncertainty of riches. Because Jesus said also, where your heart is, what, there your treasure will be also. So if their sole focus is on something else, then that's their God. That's the ruling desire of their heart. Let it be what lies have been embraced. The lie must be, might be, you know, I got to have peace at all costs. You know, I won't feel good. I got to have peace. Maybe it's a lady who's turned to alcohol because her husband committed adultery. Or maybe she's turned to food. Or I had the guys in the program. I thought it would be a great idea to join a gym and get the guys at working out. Their bodies have just been beat to a pulp out here using dope all these years. And guess what? I learned real quick. They turned that into a God. That was a God replacement. So I had to limit that, as weird as that is. You know, so we could only, I restricted the time and the days that we could go because they'd skip Bible study, you know, to work out. And I thought, oh, we can't be doing that. So what lies have been embraced? I had a lady one time that turned into shopping, a shopping addict. You know, she couldn't be happy unless she had all this stuff. So addiction doesn't, again, have to do with just drugs and alcohol. Letter C, all of this is just unpacking the issues of the heart. What patterns have been developed, right? This is one of the problems with addiction is the heart, as I said a minute ago, is hardwired to be habitual. And great, great benefit that God has made us that way. But you know what? Name me one thing that we as humans haven't perverted. Any one good, perfect thing that God's given us that we haven't perverted. We even pervert worship of Him. You know, and so these, we got to be careful because as these habits are formed, these these patterns can be developed that aren't glorifying to God. So total life restructuring, guess what? It's not going to be an overnight deal. And for when you're dealing with a couple and it's the husband that's like this, mama needs to understand that. He is not going to wake up tomorrow morning and have this all under control, right? So in conclusion, you know, understanding the two levels of addiction, the symptom, what we see, the slavery to a substance or an activity, the causal addiction, the God replacement, what is it that's ruling their heart? And we got to go back to counseling 101 and be really good data gatherers. Then we got to teach radical amputation. And then we got to teach total life restructuring, right? And it is going to be, understand, it's very time consuming, right? Teach them what to put off, what to put on. But now we're really at the final point here, addressing the real issue, the heart, right? And that's where you got to dive in really deep. So we'll take a 5-minute break, and we're going to develop a strategy for helping somebody that has come to you with a pornography addiction. And I'll just probably do a lot of reading for that one and make it go quick. So.